welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Christina Borgeson. My co-host, Celia Farber, is away on personal assignment. My guest today, in the shrinking world of investigative journalism, is a living miracle. Seymour Hersh persistently exposed the country's darkest secrets while maintaining a very high-profile career for more than 50 years, and he's still on the job. On top of that, and this is a big part of the miracle, he's consistently adhered to the highest journalism standards, standards that have all but disappeared today. He's pissed off a lot of people and taken a lot of flack, including having to fight off 7 libel proceedings during his career. He's a master storyteller, and in his latest book, a memoir titled simply Reporter, he lifts the veil on his stories, his career, and how he's managed to thrive in an arena that has crushed lesser mortals. Welcome, Cy, to the Whistleblower Newsroom.
Managed to still be alive, huh? Okay.
I salute you for that. I salute you for that.
It's not that hard. It's changing oxygen for nitrogen, kiddo.
So we have only a little teeny hour, so I really want to get going on this because you really have such a prodigious career. And I think I want to start with the story that turned into your first book, The Chemical and Biological Warfare, America's Hidden Arsenal. Could you talk about how you fell on that story and what it is you exposed and who got upset at you and why?
That was a long time ago, but as much as I can dimly remember, actually, I did the story because I had been reporting. By the middle 60s, I was 27, 28. I was working for the Associated Press. I'd done the usual thing, gone to college. I went to law school, hated law school, got out, went in the Army, got out, and worked for UPI, United Press, and got a job with the AP in Chicago covering, among other things, civil rights, Martin Luther King. They were very interesting times in 63, 64. And we were beginning, you know, King was quite an amazing person. And then I'm sent to Washington, and I get into the war. And I'm writing about bombing in North Vietnam and all those things, and everybody's getting very uncomfortable about the wire services. It was very strange because I learned to hate the war on OJT, on the job. I was in the Pentagon talking to officers who were coming back from the war, and I learned, and I've been reading about the war like anybody. I mean, I was always interested in it. And I must say, I have to begin by saying if anybody's aspiring journalist, I'll give you the one aphorism that really works in terms of being a good journalist: read before you write.
Exactly.
So I was reading about the war awful, and then I was finding out from majors and captains and GIs it was a killing field. So I knew that. And so I get reassigned. The way the AP handled me was they were getting pressure, and so I reassigned to an investigative team they had set up.
They were getting pressure because of your work or just generally?
Because of my work, absolutely. I mean, I had senior officials with. It was a different world then, and you had wire stories, and they would run on the AP wire, and I'd turn the story into my editors, and they would schedule it. It'd start running at 5 o'clock in the afternoon for the morning newspapers the next day for their deadline, and the people, Arthur Sylvester, a very famous man, who at that time, because he was such a son of a bitch about being unnice to reporters that didn't toe the line, they would come into the office and scream at me while the story was running on the wire, "We're going to get you for this." That kind of stuff was very melodramatic, because the press room was right down the hall from some of the senior officials. McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, was on a higher floor, but his deputies were right next to us. Anyway, I mean, big deal.
Wasn't this Sylvester, his job was to contain you guys and make sure?
Yeah, he was sort of famous for, you know, bragging about how he could muffle us and he, you know, how pathetic we were. He really didn't have much respect for the press, Arthur Sylvester. He also believed in, you know, the noble lie And so, but that's the important thing is the AP, I get on I'm assigned to an investigative panel, and I had ideas of what to do, but nobody was interested in what I wanted to do about the war. And there was a wonderful journalist named Eleanor Langer, last time I thought about her, she was teaching at Reed College, I think. She's quite brilliant, and she wrote a series of articles for Science Magazine then, which was a publication of the AAAS Science, the main, I guess, the lobbying association, what you will, for science associations. Anyway, they published a wonderful magazine with a good news section, and she wrote about chemical and biological warfare, and I sort of knew that this, because there have been hearings about some of America's chemical work and biological work, there have been hearings, and there was a story in a major magazine about it sort of lifting the lid. I knew that would pass muster for the editors, and it did. And there was, it's most of the media is so caught up in self-censorship that that's always been the issue. It's not only self-censorship of the reporters, it's also self-censorship of the editors. And so this is the 60s,
yes.
This is novel, but I had something that had been written in the magazine critically looking at it. Eleanor Langer did that, and one thing I did was I knew I could find people actually in the program, officers, and she was writing externally based, and I found people that were actually inside, you know, who sniffed the bombs and the bugs, if you will. So I spent months traveling around, and I wrote a series about it, and I wrote maybe 15,000 words of four-part series for the AP. It's a lot for the AP, but they have these things. They special features. It was a special feature, and that was not that inconsistent with other things they'd done. And I turn it in, and nothing happens for weeks and weeks. And I did do write about this in the memoir, I remember. And the editor.
Yeah,
was,
you did. I mean, you were talking about how what you did that was different was that you exposed that they weren't just creating these defensive biological, but they were doing offensive ones.
And more than that, I got some people on the inside to tell me just what they were doing, where they were.
750-pound bombs within hours. They could put diseases in storm. They could put biological agents in these big bombs within hours.
And they were working with people like the famous James Watson of the Double Helix.
Yep.
I mean, they had some amazing, they were working on plagues and tularemias. They were working on all sorts of toxic stuff, and they had problems. They have a major secret facility in rural Maryland up in the mountains right near Camp David, where the president has a retreat in the mountains north of about 40-50 miles north of Washington, going towards West Virginia, I guess. Anyway, they had had monkeys escape from containment with diseases. They had had laboratory people die of changing a light bulb in a laboratory without the right equipment and getting a rare disease that killed them, and they would the funerals would be held with the cast closed, and I had all that sort of dramatic stuff, and nobody knew nothing. You know how it goes.
Yeah, yeah. What about those 6,000 sheep?
Well, that was later. They killed 6,000 sheep with nerve gas in an experiment. By that time, I'd done my book, and nobody wanted that story. Except, remember Ramparts, the old lefty magazine?
Yep, 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 yep.
Ramparts did it great, but at that time, I simply did this series, and it sat for weeks with the editor. And one day, he reached into a desk drawer, and I'm just wondering what the hell's going on with this place at the AP. Although there was a lot of good things they did. They let me run. I could do what I wanted. But in this case, they obviously weren't that interested in what I was doing. He called me over, and he gave me the stack of 15,000 words, and he said, cut it down to one story.
God.
And
God.
So I did, of course. What else could I do? And they ran it on midnight on Sunday night or Monday night or Saturday night, some dead time. And I had written the United States, the lead of my story, is we were spending, you know, $300 million a year on offensive chemical and biological warfare experiments or whatever. And they'd added these lines to match the same amount of spending by the Soviet Union, about which nobody knew nothing. They just added that without telling me.
Oh, my God.
I was out of there. So, but then the punishment for it, not that I cared. I then people made me book offers, and I wrote a book about it. And it was just the same. It was called Chemical and Biological Warfare. And you know what happened? It's published in 68. The war is going bad. And I was giving a lot of talks on campuses. I also, even in 67 when I left the AP, or 66, whenever it was, I wrote, before the book was published, I wrote a bunch of pieces for the New Republic, which was a different magazine than than it is now, about biological warfare. And it was on campus. They had contracts on campus. So it was a great, fun thing to do. And I began going to a lot of campuses to speak on that issue. And then, of course, the anti-war, there were always young guys by 67 who had been in the war for a year, from 65 and 66, and they were back ready to talk to me about what they'd done. So I was getting a sense then, again, as I had in the Pentagon, I was getting a sense then of this. I just was collecting, and sort of not in the back of my mind, I just knew that this was, I wouldn't call it Murder Incorporated, but let's just put it this way. There weren't very many prisoners of war in South Vietnam.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, did you see that Winter Soldiers documentary?
Well, of course.
Where they were talking about throwing prisoners out of helicopters so they didn't have to worry about them.
But you have to remember, that was 1971. It was completely ignored by the mainstream press.
Well, I mean, look, this is obviously part of why we're talking. I just want to circle back to your chemical warfare thing for just a minute, because I know the whole Vietnam scene is synonymous with your name, so I want to get into that in some depth. But I was just very interested in your book. You talk about the Pentagon, they were so upset about your reporting on the chemical biological warfare stuff that they went to Mike Wallace of 60 Minutes. And do you remember that? And they had
they tried to do counter propaganda. That's all. And they did get networks to they gave them access to, even I think at one point, to a biological lab. And they showed how they were.
Yeah, Pine Bluff Arsenal in Arkansas.
Yeah, right. And they were showing how the munitions could be filled, and they put the filling of munitions and the care with which they work, et cetera, et cetera. And the whole point was to legitimize the effort as something we're only doing for defensive purposes, again, in case Russia does it, et cetera, that sort of stuff.
What was shocking to me was Mike's narration when he said, and I'm quoting from your book, to bring chemical biological weapons into the sphere of rational discussion, sort of delousing it or debugging it, like kids learning there aren't any ghosts.
Yes.
I mean, you have to understand, Si, I come from TV. I worked at CBS. I worked in the CBS Reports unit. And, 60 Minutes was really the bomb, for everybody. And, when I see this, and obviously I know that 60 Minutes has a long history of doing stuff like this, but it's just, it's really nauseating. You're so used to it, I think it has shock value, and it has shock value even now, I think, and it's part of the problem.
But another way of looking at it is I'm way past the shock value. So I look at it in almost a mechanical way. It was always interesting to me how the military knew they could trade off access for what they needed, for the kind of comments they would get. In other words, nobody had ever been allowed to film at Pine Bluff before. It's in Arkansas. It's a very secret place where they do make all sorts of. Biological weapons, and so. But they can trade access. The equivalent would be, in a way, if you remember, when we began the war in the second Gulf War in 2003, we embedded reporters with military
units. Yep, of course.
Exactly, they understood there's a trade-off. You give the reporter access. If he sees, a bunch of guys anxiously, and in all fairness, nervously, not necessarily with mens rea to kill, but at a checkpoint, asking somebody driving at a checkpoint, and this happens so often, the guy doesn't look like he's going to stop, and they scream at the car, stop in English, and put up a sign, and the guy keeps on going, so they unload on the car, and of course it's full of five babies or something like that, whatever the cliche is. That happens all the time. And if you're embedded, there were a lot of people who actually, a few wrote about it. They were early in that war, the Gulf War, when the Americans were rolling across from the desert from into Baghdad. The goal was to get to Baghdad. They were coming out of Jordan. They would pass villages and crossroads, and often they would open up on people without much with no warning. And the reporters would later write about how they were so ambivalent about it because they saw the thing, you know, this is there anything more dangerous than an 18-year-old frightened guy with a weapon? You know,
right.
The enemy's there. They're that's we all given.
Well, I mean, I think that's all fine and good for one part of the story, but if you're not sending out people unembedded as well from your news organization, and if you don't have enough and you have to make a choice, unembedded, I think, is better.
Well, of course.
And that's kind of the problem, you know. But
they embedded every anchor.
Yeah.
For the main news.
I know.
But that wasn't casual. That was quite brilliant. And you got to give them their due. I mean, they beat the hell out of any potential criticism for a long time on that war by doing so.
Well, I give them their due.
You got to give them their due. You're not dealing with dummies.
What bothers me is you know, our tribe. You know, the journalists. I just
you still have some illusions, huh?
Yeah. Well, no, I didn't, but I still have that every time I see it happen. So even to this day, you know what goes through my mind? As ridiculous as it sounds, what goes through my mind is, does your mother know you're doing this? You know, I mean, it's such a huge responsibility. It's such a huge public service.
It's funny you say that because that was my wife's question for the Kennedy girl. Remember the one that became ambassador, the granddaughter or the daughter of
Kennedy? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
She decided to run for the Senate.
Yep.
Remember that? I do remember that with her patrician voice.
Yep.
There's
yep.
a mother. Well, I mean, what would Jackie have said? That was a thought we all had. That does your mother know you're doing this? Yes, that's actually a nice way of looking at it. I think if you ask that question of everybody in wartime, you might reduce the violence quite a bit. But the answer is they don't know, and they're not going to tell you.
Well,
they're not going to tell their mothers.
I know. Well, I have a son who's an officer in the Marine Corps, and I know there's plenty he doesn't tell me. But
that's a natural response.
No, I understand that. I actually kind of appreciate it, I guess, on the mother level. On the other level, maybe I'd be I'm a little more curious, but I want to move on to the story that really is synonymous with your name.
Well, let me ask you why you asked about chemical and biological warfare, that book. So, you know, it's there. It was I'm proud of it. It was, you know, I love all my children, right? It's a good book. Is just something you were interested in, or just something?
Well, because I think it's one of those issues that really is where you are at such huge risk and you don't even know it, you know, as the
yes.
public.
Yeah. Well, and it was in that sense. Nobody had ever quite codified how bad things were, how much they were doing without telling anybody. Nobody had done. And so it was a natural story. It's not that Eleanor Langer, in her work, didn't touch on all of that. She did. I mean, she opened the door for me. She made it possible because she was also writing critically. She was a very astute journalist. But there's nothing like having some colonel who just retired tell you how crazy it all is.
yeah. The guy who's looked inside the Pandora's box and
actually seen what they're doing and knows the volatility of it and knows the incredible double talk that they do when they talk themselves into some position. But that's the way.
What I can't understand is their lack of imagination that they too are, you know, going to be subject to this if all hell breaks loose. And
well, let's put it this way: if the wind blows the wrong way, you're all in trouble. That's
yeah, exactly. I mean, so
anyway, go on. Sorry, I interrupted you. I shouldn't be asking questions.
No, please do, please do. I mean, this is a conversation, not an inquisition. So, Milai is, of course, synonymous with your name. And if you say Milai to a millennial, they probably wouldn't know, even though, I mean, it was such a huge, huge thing, your reporting from Vietnam. Could you just start rolling on that and talk about it?
You know, here's the thing. The thing is that one can come and, I've taken a look at it again last year because of something I picked up somewhere. And as much as the good I did, I wrote a story about a massacre where the American government was basically in parts of Vietnam, and depending on the local leader, the warfare is all small unit leadership. If the guy running the captain and the platoon leaders, the lieutenants, are good, decent people, there'll be limits set. And this is My Lai was the unit that did this case. It was known as Charlie Company, and there was a platoon leader named William Kelly, Rusty Kelly, he was known, who was found guilty later by a group of peers, his army court-martial of the premeditated murder of 22, but the number probably was many more. They went into a village one day being told they'd meet the enemy there. There was no enemy, and instead of dealing with the people there in a rational way, they opened up on all the people, and they ended up just going all out and killed anywhere between I think the official count is if we ever did would be about 440 people. Some people escaped. The village probably had 600 people in it, and another unit, Cali was a platoon leader in a company known as Charlie Company, and there was a second company that went to another village about a mile away, maybe less, a kilometer, which is, 6/10 of a mile. My Lai 4 was one, another one named Mi K, and they killed 100 people there. And this all would have been unremarked except that it happened. Nobody knew anything. It was reported as a great victory, and that the war went on. And a year later, a young soldier who'd come back from Vietnam, who was actually, I think, literally was afraid to do anything, a man named Ronald Reidenauer, there's a prize in yep. Washington named the Reidenauer Prize. He was the most amazing young fellow. He was a soldier. He finished his tour of duty. Before he finished, he heard from friends about what happened at My Lai, even though it was never prosecuted. He started collecting information on his own. When he came back to America, he went to college at Claremont in California, and he resolved to do something about it. He thought he'd write something, but nobody was interested. I separately learned in Washington in 6 months after it would have been in the fall. Reidenauer came back about a year and a month, 13 months after My Lai. Nothing had been done. It had been covered up. There was an investigation, but they went nowhere. And they just went and murdered and, maimed and did what they did. The soldiers way out of control. There's a lot more to be told about the story that I may or, it's ancient history, as you said, the millennials, let's not let them be the judge of what we write.
Well, the interesting thing to me is how in these big historical stories, how moving from, say, the Vietnam War to the Iraq War, there are certain figures who emerge again and play the same role. Colin Powell, he was notified by a young specialist fourth-class guy named Tom Glenn.
Yes, he was given, he discounted, he was told about the, look, I know what you're talking about. Powell was also, he came on that scene a year later. And at that time, everybody knew everything, of course. They all knew that a company had gone completely crazy and killed 500 people. As opposed to what normally happens on a mission like that, you go in and you kill a few dozen, and that's your kill for the day. They're all non-combatants. They're all people presumably protected by the Geneva Convention, but that's not the way anybody looked at it then and even now. The army escaped.
Well, I think what bothered me was that Powell, because this guy was saying there was routine brutality against civilians. He wasn't just talking about these massacres, And Powell just came back and basically said, this is not true. In fact, relations between AmeriCal soldiers and the Vietnamese people are excellent. And he just covered up the whole thing, instead of, trying to do anything, even, something minimal, like...
You know, I think you're holding him, with all due respect. I don't know what's in his mind at all. I mean, I've never talked to him about it, and he's denied any all these things, but... Let me finish this thought, just so you know.
Okay.
For Powell or anybody to have begun to react to the fact that random killings took place on almost every mission, that non-combatants were not considered to be non-combatants, were considered to be Viet Cong or Viet Cong allies. Even the infants, they're going to grow up to be Viet Cong. And so that kind of stuff was so prevalent for anybody in the military to make a step towards doing something about it officially. It's a death knell. It's the end of their career. I mean, I say that very seriously. That in 68, 69, and 70 in Vietnam, if you went there, if you're a lieutenant colonel and you got a battalion and you had three or four companies working for you, if you did your killing, you didn't do anything excessive, pretended you had a lot more engagement with the enemy than you did because nobody wanted to be in too much contact with them, I don't think. There was, of course, a lot of people did fantastic stuff in terms of warfare, but very many of the officers were not that interested in doing much. And you got your Silver Star after 6 months, and you got a chance to be a battalion commander or a brigade commander and make it the general, and nobody was going to rock the ship. And it's all done by how many people you kill. I mean, it was so institutionalized. Assuming that anybody in a village that you go to attack, by and large, a large percent of them are going to be Viet Cong or Viet Cong sympathizers. It's just what we did. It's one of the most amazing parts of the war, that we never considered people to be prisoners of the war. We never considered, if you were there living in a village that we didn't like, and you were there even after we used to send leaflets around, urging people to say, you know, leave this city because they're full of bad people. We had these crude messages we'd send that, of course, I don't know what they did with the paper, but they sure didn't pay much attention to it. And so it was such a disaster.
I mean, I just think, you know what, I'll tell you why these details bother me so much. It's because of the long view, okay? If you start, for example, with, you know, Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, and Ellsberg basically on the first day of the job starts to realize that, you know, the Tonkin, literally on the first day of the job, you know, Tonkin Gulf starts happening, and he realizes right away that it's all bullshit, right? And then you know, we go to war. And, you know, Ellsberg goes over there. Have you ever seen that show that was done on him? I think it was by the BBC. I forget.
You mean Dan?
He goes over there, and he's, you know, out with McNamara, and McNamara says things are going swimmingly, and he's watching him lie. And, you know, he's reading these, he's reading these reports where these Vietnamese, there's a chart that shows that these South Vietnamese patrols are being done all over the country, and he decides he wants to go out on patrol with one of them, and then he's told by some guy in the battalion, well, actually, this chart is just BS, it's not true, there are no patrols, and he just starts realizing how out of control the thing is. And then, of course, you know, he exposes the Pentagon Papers and is charged with the Espionage Act, and then you get into the war. And then it's all this chaos and murder and mayhem and whatnot, you know. And then the war is over. 2 million Vietnamese are dead. 58,000 Americans are dead, you know. And, you know, obviously before that, now you have five presidents, starting with Eisenhower, who gave money to the French, who were trying to get rid of a nationalist movement that was universally supported by the Vietnamese. The long view is so horrific to me, Cy, you know? And it's like then you move to the Iraq War, and it's like we're repeating history again, literally the same way.
Well, it's only 19 years or 18 years in the Iraq War.
But the start was similar.
You've got to give it time to get it straight, right?
Well...
What can I tell you?
No, but do you understand? Well, do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, because
what do you think? Do you think I've been living in a hole somewhere? Of course, I understand what you're saying.
No. But I guess what I'm saying is, I wish, for example, as reporters, I wish reporters would put more context in their reporting. I wish there were more accountability. I wish reporting were strong enough to get accountability. I think we'll get into this, because I think your instinct was to try and do that. You did your book on Kissinger, for example, you know.
Sure.
And there never is accountability, you know, on the leadership who send us into these criminal, illegal enterprises are never held accountable.
Just like in corporations, absolutely. How do you change that? What do you do?
That's my question to you. In your experience, everything that you have reported on, which is about these more extreme activities that our nation engages in with, you know, with these leaders at the helm, what is your assessment?
Well, I've been around a long time. I'm 82. I'm as old as you can get, right? And it'll walk upright. And so I've watched it forever, and I'll give the media a little bit of a pass, because not much, but a little bit. In the heyday when I was there, let's say I was at the New Yorker and the New York Times in the 80s and 90s and 70s, I worked for, you know, at the top sort of people that had money. There was cash. There was there were editors then who I worked with a bunch of editors who were not afraid to go against the grain, even though, you know, people like me are always sort of a pain. But right now you've got newspapers that I was just showing somebody. I had breakfast with somebody from Europe today, and I opened up this morning's New York Times, and literally there was let's see, house ad. They had one full page, a couple of little things. They don't have any advertising. They make much of their money doing, you know, trips and schools and all this stuff that they do on the side, and selling books and online. And so there's no luxury. There's no, you can't say to somebody, you can't say to two or three good reporters, I want you to take even two. At the New York Times, I spent 6-8 months on stories. And went wherever I wanted. Nobody has that money now. So there's an overriding non-intellectual problem. I mean, nothing that can be solved by different minds. You don't have the money to do the kind of reporting it needs to be done. It takes a long time to do certain stories when they're particularly national security stuff. So you have to rely on what they tell you.
Well, that is what I think has killed interest in journalism to a large extent.
It's killed interest in bad journalism.
Official source reporting. What?
I said it's killed interest in bad, lousy reporting, but there's other places people go to. There's a lot of options now that there weren't. I mean, you know,
right.
I'm always a little disappointed at the New York Times, where I worked for years, that they don't seem to get it on a lot of issues. And they're so busy writing about Trump because it gets on page one, you know, that they're missing
right.
a lot of stories. But there's other venues. There's other things. There's right now. What is this? A podcast? I mean, you know, I'm so square. I hardly know. You do a podcast, right? Podcasts are huge.
That's right.
Now.
You're going to be on four different platforms.
Well, but here's the
point. Probably never heard of, but they're good.
No. But of course not, because I'm. You know, what do I know? I mean, I'm sure my children do. My children know. They know. It's a whole different media market now. The newspapers don't drive and dominate it now. Unfortunately, one of the dominating factors is this dumb stuff called cable news, this
right.
CNN, MSNBC stuff, and the Fox News. They're a pox on all of them, whether they're left or right. They're all just so
right.
horrible. They diminish everything. Everything is, you know, I know it's square to say this, but when I did a good story for the New York Times, let's say that when I worked there daily, I worked there 8 years, some daily story, the idea of going on a TV show that night to talk about my story would be just what? The words speak for themselves. It's pretty amazing. It was just something we didn't do. Now it's just, if you don't do it, you're missing it.
Well, I mean, it is a powerful medium, and you can tell your story. I think the problem is that there are no more journalism standards are non-existent anymore. You put no context. You take facts. You don't even check them. You know, you take an official source A and official source B, and you throw them up against each other, and that's what you call reporting. A seven-year-old could do that, you know? And I think, I mean, look, I had Dan Rather kill a story I was doing on who was doing what during the run-up to Iraq, to the Iraq War, to push us into the war. And, you know, why? It was very interesting. I had a chat with Colonel Wilkerson, you know, yeah, who was chief of staff to Colin Powell, and he was trying to vet Colin Powell's infamous speech to the UN, right? And he told me that John Hanna from Cheney's office had come down with a bunch of documents to vet the speech, right? And he said after a full 8 hours, full day of trying to vet page one, he couldn't vet it at all. And he went to Powell and said, listen, nothing in this thing is true. And so, and that's when, lo and behold, Tenet comes in, literally comes in and goes, oh, well, we'll use the NIE. So, and then unfolds more, you know, where you know, Wilkerson is clear that this thing is just not holding any water at all, but he's being forced to, you know, accept it. And so I call Cheney's office to talk to John Hanna and run by this scenario that Wilkerson had told me, you know, to see what Hanna had to say. And I got this chipper little woman on the phone who was telling me, well, you have to look at this, and we can send you this report and that report. I said, no, it's just a yes or no answer. This is what Wilkerson said. I'd like to know if John Hanna can confirm this, you know. The next day, Cy, the next day, I walk into the office, and I'm told, who the hell do you think you are calling Dick Cheney's office, okay?
You're kidding
me. A few days later.
Oh, wait. As long as you're telling a story, where does that come from? Some editor or what? Where does that message come from?
It came from Wayne Nelson, who was the senior producer of Dan Rather Reports, okay, on Mark Cuban's network, okay? And this story, I'd been working on this story, I can't even tell you, it was called The Cabal, you know, and it was all about the Office of Special Plans and all that, right?
Sure.
And two things happened. Before that, I was told by another senior producer, who are these people that you're interviewing? Because I was interviewing Tyler Drumheller, and I was interviewing Karen Kwiatkowski, who was actually bunked there in the Pentagon with the Office of Special Plans folks, you know, and I was talking to Wilkerson. Who are these people? I've never heard of these people. I mean, just to tell you the level of just blindness there. And then when this thing happened, because obviously a call was, you know, made to Dan, and Wayne Nelson brought me in. Who the hell do you think you are? And I said, well, I'm a fact-checking reporter. And, you know, a week or so later, I was out of there. I was shown the door. The thing was killed. The story was killed. Hmm. Okay? And I just think
so
that...
What year is this? This is after Dan left CBS?
Oh, yeah. And I produced for Dan. We won an Emmy together, and we were nominated. We won an Emmy one year, and we're nominated for one the next year.
Let me tell you something. Tell me what year it was.
Let me think. It was 2000. Let me see. It was after my book. I did this book where I interviewed a bunch of people, you know, big reporters like Koppel and all these people. It's called Feet to the Fire, about how they missed the story, and it's really, really shocking what they had to say. I mean, how blind. It's almost like a willful blindness. Let me see this year, what year this was put out, because it was a few years after that. I can't tell you exactly, hold on. Maybe 2006, 2007?
Ah, Well, I don't. I'm surprised because I always had a very high opinion of Dan. I thought Dan was always against the
grain. Dan swings both ways. That's how he has survived. He swings both ways. When he'll bend when it's necessary to save his, you know, his bacon, and then he'll apologize, you know, like he apologized after, you know, after the run up to the war where he was parroting the official sources and everything, and then he apologized. Dan swings both ways. That is my experience of Dan.
That's not atypical, you know, that going to war is a very tricky thing for the media because they tend to be totally at the mercy of the powers that be. You know, I always think of there was a wonderful admiral in World War II who was he worked on the Navy in the Pacific, did some, you know, Battle of Midway, et cetera, et cetera. And he was famous for being told that the press were waiting for an interview. It was just at a crisis time in one of the battles. And he told his aides, he said, "I'll tell you what you do with the press," he said. "Wait till the end of the war and tell them who won." And the point being that attitude is pretty dominant by many people, that basically the only reporters they want to deal with are those that they can manipulate and maneuver. And I'm surprised that Dan was able to. That surprised me. Your story surprises me because I always thought Dan was. But you know, network television is a whole different thing. I never felt that pressure.
But why should it? No, but it's a different medium, and there are different, you know, there are different limitations and whatnot. But you know what? I guess that's part of. Part of my issue, you know, because I published two books on this, on the corrupt. What I call it corruption. If you're getting a paycheck to go and find out the truth about an issue, and if you can't tell that truth, then don't report anything or get out of the business. That's how I feel. You know, because it's a public service. It's a huge responsibility, especially war reporting. And you know, people who take it on the chin, like you. I mean, you 7 libel suits. People yelling at you.
Oh, but that's I don't worry about those. I don't worry about the criticism. I just don't. That can't be a feature. That's not. There's no heroism in winning a libel suit. You know, if you do your work, you're going to win. But
it's not about being a hero for winning those libel suits. It's about attracting those libel suits.
Oh well, but
my point,
so, I'm right. I hear you, but you know, I hear your clarity. I hear your point of view. As somebody who's been in there, if you're young, it's very complicated. You're taking a very high standard, which I don't disagree with, but it's just not practical, because you know there's some very good reporters figured out after 5-10 years. So I know how
impractical it is. I paid for my impracticality. I mean, that TWA 800 story. You know, when the FBI came after me because I had a piece of evidence from inside the investigation, it took me 17 years to finally get half a dozen whistleblowers, members of the original investigation into that crash, to come forward and talk about how the truth was covered up on that one.
I don't know the story. What is the story?
You know, TWA Flight 800 that exploded off the coast of Long Island.
Sure. Famous.
Yeah,
whether it was hit by there was a question whether it was hit by a missile or not too, wasn't it?
Exactly. And so the CIA came in. I'll send you a DVD or a link to the show so you can see. I worked with a scientist, a physicist, and that's another thing about some of these big stories, like the 9/11 story, is sometimes the story is bigger than just you and your sources. There. Various types of expertise that are necessary that you may not necessarily have, you know?
Well, of course.
And in this case, the expertise was to assess the forensic evidence.
And I think the thought was that there was somebody had fired a missile that went askew, is that correct?
Ordnance was involved. ordinance was involved.
And how far did you get with the case? I remember that was sort of the finding. Was it ever definitively made?
Oh.
It was brought down by a missile?
Well, what happened was we got all these whistleblowers together in one room. And
by whistleblowers,
they filled in each other's pieces of the puzzle.
But people who witnessed it or people who wrote
no,
about it?
No. The witnesses were separate, but we also had a group eyewitness shoot. But what we had was we had one whistleblower was the National Transportation Safety Board senior investigator in charge of assembling the plane when it came out, the interior of the plane when it was dragged out of the ocean. We had TWA's investigator who was part of the official investigation. We had the medical examiner who was there. We had a medical forensic analyst who was brought in as an expert for the NTSB. His job was to match the damage to the corpses with the damage to the plane. We had the Airline Pilot Association's official investigator. I'm trying to remember who the other person was. But anyway, we had all these people who actually handled the evidence and had, you know,
So was this on air or was this an episode?
Oh, yeah, it aired on the Epix cable channel. But, Cy, that took me 17 years, and, of course, you know, I don't know, I lost two jobs trying to report on TWA. I lost my job at CBS, and I lost my job at ABC, working on a pilot for ABC.
I have to ask you this question. Were you in trouble because maybe they wanted you to cover other stories, and you kept on doing the one you did?
Well, in the case of CBS, what happened was I had been sent a piece of seat foam that had some red stuff on it. It had come from inside the investigation, and I was told by the person sending it to me that it was solid rocket missile fuel residue, okay? And so I told him, I said, okay, I said, I will accept this. I went, obviously, to my boss, and I said, look, can I accept this thing? And he said, sure. And at that point, it was going to be for a piece for 60 minutes because I was waiting to be put on a new documentary because I was actually in the doc unit. But anyway, so the piece was FedExed to me, and the FBI had been bird-dogging the guy who had that piece of evidence. And they bird-dogged that FedEx right straight to me. And I got a call from my boss, and she said, Christina, the FBI is here to see you. They say you have a piece of evidence and that it's been stolen. And I said, no, it was not stolen from the investigation. And technically it was not, because one of the investigators who was there officially had given it to this other guy who gave it to me. So it hadn't been stolen. And he had a right to have it tested outside of, you know, normal channels if he wanted to. But the FBI didn't see it that way. And there were so many leaks going on because a lot of people were suspicious of the investigation. And so, you know, they came and they said, no, it's been stolen. CBS gave it right back, and they kept me away from a grand jury that the FBI had set up because so many leaks were happening. They were sending people who were leaking, they were sending them to this grand jury. So anyway, I was protected from that, but shown the door, you know, a few weeks later. So... And I'll tell you something, the second time that I was shut down, okay, the second time that I was shut down working on this little pilot for ABC, doing a story on, you know, there's trouble inside the investigation, people are leaking, what's going on, I had my car broken into, very professional job, they took papers and computer and left everything else, you know, intact, and it didn't even look like it was broken into until I opened the thing. And then I was shut down. The whole pilot for the entire series was shut down because of the TWA show. And you know what was even more interesting, though, Cy? Was as I was being shut down, all these little articles showed up in Time, New York Times, Newsweek, and, you know, major paper, New York Post. Why? Because the pilot was for a show called Declassified. It was going to be an edgier 60 Minutes, top-notch investigative reporting, right?
On the network?
Yes, it was going to be for the ABC network, but it was going to be on the entertainment side, and it was going to be hosted by Oliver Stone.
What year was this?
It was, again, in the mid, it was right after, you know, I left CBS and a couple of years later, so early 2000s.
Never heard of it. Go ahead.
And so anyway, all of a sudden, as my piece ended up killing the entire series, okay, and I had barely started to shoot anything, and I hadn't spoken to anybody about it, all of a sudden, there was this spate of coverage from New York Times, Newsweek, Time Magazine, etc. Conspiracy crank Oliver Stone is going to do a piece on TWA that's going to say a missile shot it down. I had barely started to shoot the thing.
Do you believe that's what happened?
Yes. Yes. So, you know,
and that's
why.
Where do you think the missile came from?
Where do I think it came from?
Uh-huh.
Oh, well, let me tell you something. The reason why I'm not going to answer that question is because the reason why I survived even doing the documentary that I did was I didn't speculate at all. All I did was, as a matter of fact, it pissed off a lot of people, including Oliver Stone, who saw it, that I did not say, oh, you know, a missile from whatever hit it. We went through the forensic evidence with these whistleblowers, and they, you know, determined that it was ordnance that brought this thing down. We presented all the forensic evidence, and we left it at that. What we could prove is what we put in there, because on a story like that, as you well know, you've done stories like that, you can't go an inch beyond what you can actually show, what you can actually document. And so that's what we did. And that's how I've managed to stay out of the conspiracy bin.
But you know, on television, television is a much tougher. I've done some documentaries too, and I find it a much tougher medium because you can in print somehow. You can always find somebody to articulate something for you. Television is much more complicated. The television news is really, that's what makes it so sad that we don't get enough of it. It's so much easier to run with the president gave a tweet today, and then you're all talking about it all day, and you bring in talking heads, and that takes care of 4 hours of newscasts on the cable television.
Yeah, but look at what's happened. I mean, by the way, before I see the time is slipping away, and I feel terrible about this, I wanted to ask you something about, remember, there's a thing on YouTube with you talking about Seth Rich.
Oh,
that just,
I don't know. The
lit my hair on fire, you said...
Yeah, I know what I said.
What did you say?
It doesn't matter. That tape was, the person who taped it did not tell me he was taping it, and I was...
Well, here's why I'm interested in that. You know, because forensic evidence for me is very important. For 9/11, it's very important.
Before you say something to me about it, let me tell you, that was a tape that didn't include some disclaimers.
Okay. Well, give me the disclaimers because let me explain to you why I'm interested in that. Okay. You know, again, forensic evidence for 9/11. Nobody wants to look at the forensic evidence. Everybody's talking about the documentation. This one was over here. That one was over here. I'm very interested in the fact that you were talking about Muhammad Atta being the person of interest.
I just think Muhammad Atta probably had a lot. He clearly had more to do with it. But the trouble with talking about something is that Go ahead. I'll hear.
Well, you said that a high place, highly placed source of yours got the FBI to show him Seth Rich's file, and that in the file they
you're talking about 9/11.
That he was probably the one who leaked
the DNC. No, you're talking about 9/11.
Oh, 9/11. Oh, well, I was going to do Seth Rich first, and then 9/11.
You said I thought you were talking about 9/11. You said.
No. I was talking about first.
Seth Rich,
well,
that was about the Hillary the tape recording, the Julian Assange stuff.
Right. Right.
Yeah, but the problem with talking about it is that the fact of the matter is there was a disclaimer that wasn't aired.
What was the disclaimer?
There's so many things I wrote that we could talk about. This is something that I had a conversation with somebody that was explained to me. There was no way I would talk like that if I thought there was anybody going to say it was a private conversation. So I thought.
Well, let me just say something though.
That doesn't mean I knew what I was talking about.
The NSA's Bill Binney and another tech genius, computer tech genius named Skip Folden. He was an IBM guy. You know, they got together along with some other people. Oh, gotta go.
Okay.
It was a pleasure
talking
to you.
Anyway, thank you for calling. Bye-bye.